Jurassic Park's production designer, Rick Carter, crafted a thrilling and inventive extension to Michael Crichton's original screenplay by making one himself. It is an obscure and overlooked piece of Jurassic Park's rich cinematic history. Thankfully, Rick is here to finally delve into the details with me, Derek Davis, as to why he decided to task himself with such an endeavor. You took Michael Crichton's final draft of his script for the original Jurassic Park. Like, that was his last draft. He was only going to do a few and then hand it off to someone else. And for whatever reason, you came up with the idea of taking all these different ideas that came from different meetings and, you know, from Steven and yourself, and you cobbled them all together into your own version of Michael Crichton's script. So what actually inspired you to do that?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you know, I was young and wildly ambitious, and not ambitious because I wanted to be the screenwriter. That wasn't going to happen. It had to do with Steven and all of us were having such amazing conversations as we explored where the movie could go based upon Michael's book. And I knew Michael Crichton through my mother. So I already knew him as a person independent of all of this. So I knew what he was writing from his book and a conversation with Steven. And we were developing all sorts of ideas for scenes and contexts that it was fine for him to do his version. But when it went to the next step, there was a Malia Scotch-Marmo who was brought on. And I wasn't part of those meetings. And I knew that many of the things that we were discussing were going through Steven to her, and that he was wanting to see what she would bring. But it was making it a little bit hard, as I remember, to know what to coordinate for the art department to focus on. I mean, we knew the main road attack would be there. We had to design the spitter. The spitter would be there. We knew there was a raptor pen. You know, we knew certain things, but there was a whole river extravaganza. There were a lot of things that were in the book that we were still playing out and exploring. So I wanted to get something that in front of Steven that we could use as our working document. And I started to write sort of memos that would outline scenes, and I'd throw images with them and that kind of thing. But it got to be where it almost was easier to do it as a screenplay form. And then, of course, once I entered into that, I started just putting in dialogue and, you know, whatever, or whatever I took from the book that I thought was still really good. And it wasn't that I wanted to supersede what Malia was doing. It was more that I wanted to complement it so that we could keep moving forward. And also, as I remember, I was heading into what was then going to be a delay because, you know, Steven wanted to do the movie, but no one was quite ready on lots of levels. So from the computers to the deal, all sorts of things. And so that's why I went off to do Hook. And then I went off to do Death Becomes Her with Bob. So right before that, I didn't want to have it be so vague. You know, like it could get very too loose with the artists that I was keeping on to, you know, develop these things that we thought we would want, you know, the visitor center and raptor pen and that kind of thing. So I just felt somehow the desire to put it into a form, and it turned out to be a screenplay form. That's why I wrote the cover letter, though. This is not to be taken as a screenplay. And he never took it as a screenplay, like, oh, okay, you're giving me your version. It was more like, okay, this is what we've been talking about in this form. So then Malia did her version, but it, in a way, it as I remember, but I may be wrong, it did kind of drift off from certain things we were talking about that didn't build upon what Michael had done in quite the ways that I was trying to build upon that. And then, of course, that came back once they brought David Koepp on. And then I had known David Koepp at that point a little bit because of Death Becomes Her. So it all kind of got back on track in terms of the communications. But I don't really remember what pushed me fully into, except for, you know, I'm sure like what happened was after 20 pages, I just couldn't stop, that kind of thing, you know? And so for you to pick up on it and go, oh, look at this, you know, is really pretty interesting, because I certainly had not thought about it, you know, in all these time. I just knew that it existed. And so I don't know if that really answers the question fully. It's not to say anything other than it's what I do. I just fill in the gaps as I see them, the best that I can with whatever, sort of like Malcolm X used to say, by any means necessary. And that became the means at that moment to convey what I thought was a version that maybe I might have felt that certain things might have gotten dropped or waylaid, you know, in the process. And I wanted to make sure there was some form given to them, so that if we were going to not do them, that we would, you know why, you know, give them their due, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my memory of it at the moment.
What did Steven Spielberg think when he saw your script, knowing that you weren't trying to supersede anybody, but like, what did he think of your collection of ideas?
I think he registered it. I really don't remember specifically, like, you know, what he called it, said, you know, good job or bad job, or why are you doing this, or good job. He certainly never put me down for doing it. I'd have to ask him. He probably has even forgotten it, but I'm guessing that what he thought was, it's good to have this because this reflects a lot of our conversations, and maybe seeing how it played out, maybe he might have felt that the road he was on wasn't going to get him where he wanted to go, so it was good to have that. And you know, David is he and Stephen got in there, I think, more than Malia and Stephen did. You know, it's just what the dialogues are like, and at certain timing too. I don't want to. And certain people have certain aptitudes, and I can't remember. You'd have to tell me what all David brought to it, but he brought so much wit and spunk and structure. You know, he's really, really good with that. I mean, he just really knows how to set up scenes that have tension and drama and wit.
Yeah, he really made the characters come alive in his drafts, for sure. Like, he found a way to tap into, you know, the spirit of what Crichton had created in his book, and just expand upon that in a way that, you know, could come across, for one, in a shorter time span, just 2 hours instead of 400 pages, but also to really, you know, give that kind of more personal connection. Because I know Crichton's characters aren't usually very personable characters. You know, that's not how he writes, you know.
I think the other part of it is, you know, Stephen was looking for, you know, John Hammond to be more of a visionary, like Walt Disney, really, if you think about it. I mean, someone that you could believe in their vision, just has a flaw in it, but it's not inherently just money grubbing and doesn't give a shit about anything. That way, Stephen could really build into the desire to have it work and the awe of the dinosaurs. And then when it comes crashing down, you feel that there's a hubris that the humans have had, but you understand why they would do it, you know, if they could. And so that creates a much better tension than already knowing that your adversary, I mean, the adversary, again, is, it's human nature. It's not because someone's a bad person. You know, it gets a little more into that kind of thing in the next one, and the next one, and the next one. The first one, there's really no bad person. I mean, you know, if you think about the last part of the movie of number one, you do this whole thing in the beginning of that movie, which is, it's like going on a ride. You get just a little bit of a, you don't even see a raptor, but you get a little bit of a tease that something's going on. You don't see a dinosaur for an hour. And then that's why Malcolm goes, you know, are we going to have dinosaurs on this? You know, because he's commenting on the fact that it's a dinosaur movie, we haven't seen any dinosaurs. But it's a buildup of going through, you know, first it's the whole, what is the park and paleontology as subjects, then the security of the place, then the condition that it's in with the storm coming, and, you know, and then you have the, you know, how the dinosaurs were created with, you know, Mr. DNA. And so there's like five subjects that you actually, while you're waiting in line, are informed about.
Yeah, and it worked.
I thought it was interesting that you went in and you found all that stuff, and then you saw the imagery that had not been like published somewhere else, and you know, so you saw John's work, and you know, Tom Cranham, and you know, and all these people that really, you know, maybe that never even showed up in the final versions of the books they got, you know, that they made. So, and I appreciated the, you know, seeing you actually play out that story, you know, as I had written it, which was a kind of an amazing thing to see it actually played out like that, you know. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, I'm really glad. I mean, you enjoying it is like, that's like the ultimate compliment, honestly, for me and everyone who made it. Because I mean, it took like a whole, you know, team of people really to, you know, bring it to life. Like I was kind of like the architect of it, but at the same time, you know, I had one of my friends, Bernard A. Kier, he actually did all the audio and like edited the audio together. He also composed the amazing music score that you hear throughout the presentation, while a group of big Jurassic Park fans, you know, lent their voices to play all the characters, including Bernard and me. So I took his audio version, then gathered up all the production artwork I could find with other materials, like, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of files, and then visually to bring it to life. At the same time, Philip Humboldt created some illustrations to fill in the blanks for things that were specific to your script that, as far as we know, didn't exist in any official files to help illustrate your script's vision.
It's fun now to look back on it, you know, because we were all obviously professional and knew somewhat what we were doing, but we were into uncharted territory. So we still were proverbially where you'd want to be as younger filmmakers, meaning kind of kids in a candy store and trying to find out what the candy could do, you know. And that includes Stan Winston and his group, which was, they were phenomenal. And we had such a great art department as well. So, and Steven was just an amazing, amazing leader through it.
Rick Carter's script that he created for Jurassic Park may be the only one he has ever written, but it stands as a testament to how detailed he can be with his work. His passion for creating a believable yet engaging world, while still making it serve the characters and the story, is part of why all of Rick's productions are so wonderfully designed.